The date is October 28th in the year 2010. My name is Anita Hecht, and I have the great pleasure and honor of interviewing Professor Seymour Drescher on behalf of the George L. Mossy Oral History Program of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we find ourselves in the Fluno Center for Executive Education in Madison, Wisconsin. And welcome from Pittsburgh.
And thank you. My pleasure.
So here we are to talk about George Mossy. But to begin with, Professor Drescher, let's just start with a little bit about your personal and your professional background. When and where were you born?
I was born in 1934 in the Bronx, New York, where I spent the first 21 years of my life, attended public school, attended the specialized school called the Bronx High School of Science, which had the convenience of not only being an excellent school, which you had to take a specialized exam for, but it happened to be one half a block from my home, so I didn't have to wander very far. And I made my big move in New York, going down to City College in Manhattan Island. I led a very, very limited geographical life until I was 21.
What was your family background?
Family background, my parents came from Europe immediately after the First World War, I believe the same year, married in 1930, and lived very close proximity with their families in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And they were of Polish-Jewish background, one from Galicia and one from Russian Poland before the 1914 war.
Mm-hmm. Did religion play a part in your upbringing?
It was a presence, not an overwhelming presence, but my parents did belong to an Orthodox synagogue. I had a bar mitzvah. I identified with the people who were in the community and very deeply identified with them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What level of education did your parents achieve?
My parents, not beyond the sixth grade. They came over, they were both, my father was probably 12, my mother 10, and they both went to school only long enough till they could get jobs in the New York garment district. My father became a hatter. He blocked hats, he had on his hand big calluses. Mm-hmm. My mother was and worked in a tie factory. And when she was the secondary earner, but when my father lost his job and his industry, my mother continued to plug along until he could find himself a new job down at Wall Street, not as a stockbroker, but as a deliverer of large checks and other kinds of confidential information.
Interesting. What were your early interests?
Well, one of my very early interests was history.
Really?
As a kid, I used to, on Friday afternoon, head down to the public library, and there were history shelves, and I would pull everything off the shelves there was to read. And read a child's history of the world, realized that it wasn't quite so different from the biblical stories that I also had read, and just began to, I read so intensively that by the time I got to high school, I realized for most of my teachers, I knew more than they did about the period that they were talking about. It was a love that just turned into something that later became a livelihood.
Mm-hmm. So when you graduated from Bronx High School of Science, it was 1951.
51. Mm-hmm.
The historic context of your life at that point, what had influenced you?
Okay. First of all, going to a highly competitive high school, you're coming out of the Second World War. This is 1948, I head off to science. So it's an immediate aftermath of the Second World War. You're influenced by the huge mobilization. As a young man, you could follow in the newspapers the daily events of the Second World War, and of course the aftermath in 1948, also the creation of the State of Israel, an enormous number of things happening at the same time. So my interest in history was in fact slowly gearing, even in high school, toward non-American history, mm-hmm. which I thought had the tremendous traumatic events of the 20th century were leading me to think about, you know, Europe in general as a place that whose history I would like to understand. Mm-hmm. And of course the fact that my parents had fled Europe, I'm not fled, but migrated from Europe in 1920, immediately following the First World War, and were actually the last people to come in before the quotas were introduced in 1920 into immigration, which by 1924 considerably slowed down immigration from those countries which did not have a large immigrant population in the United States in 1890, I think, which was the basis of the quotas mm-hmm. system. So all those that sense of the world and the sense of the community and the sense of events, I think, weighed in on me.
Did it have a political influence on you in terms of affiliating with a party or a platform?
Well, most of the folks in my area voted for Roosevelt, voted for Truman, were Democrats, and I didn't feel any obligation to veer from that. Mm-hmm. In the Bronx High School of Science, in our discussion sections, we did have one Republican. He came from Manhattan. And when we would want to look for the Republican view, we would turn to Doug Middleman and say, what's the Republican view? Right behind me, I had a very radical student who had come from Austria and was every day, when we both looked at the Times, I would say, this is an interesting thing. And he would say, this is what it means. And he would give me the party line. It was very interesting to listen to. If I disputed it, he sometimes became very upset. He said, come the revolution, we'll see what you have to say. And actually, it worried me a bit. I thought, gee, I didn't realize I had an enemy.
Did you experience any anti-Semitism yourself?
Very little. I was assaulted once, but around that was by people who are not around the block. Every once in a while on Halloween, people would come over and invade the territory and claim it. But for the most part, it was a very mixed group, and mixed religious and ethnic group, and there was zero anti-Semitism manifest there. It was really a very coherent and very friendly block.
And even though your parents hadn't had the opportunity for a higher education, did they want that for their children?
My father told me, I said, you know, you take your child to work. They now introduced. I once asked him if I could go to work with him. I was terribly fascinated by the calluses on his knuckles, and he said, you will never enter that place. You're going to college. Okay. And there was no question that they were both, that was my fate.
Right.
What he couldn't decide is what I was going to do in college. Of course, he wanted me to become a doctor, and I did, but not the kind that he wanted. And so he would refer to me as a Schmeckel doctor, that is, one who does no good for anybody immediately.
So when you started college, were you already fairly sure that you were headed
I was divided. I had a wonderful biology lab, and I flirted with biology, but sometimes you want to stick with the one that brung you, and I was already so into history and so interested in it and so fascinated by it. I had a couple of fabulous professors, including a German Czech professor, Hans Kohn, who really made Europe come alive for us. And so I by the time I was a junior, I was hooked on history for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Was there a particular area of study at that point for you?
Well, as an undergraduate, I mean, you had to go take a variety of courses, but still it was European history, 19th, 20th century, which had grabbed me most.
Okay. And you graduated with your BA in 1955?
That's right, with a major in history, yeah.
Tell me what happens next.
Well, then when you're in your graduating year, you are going to go off to college. And I was fortunate enough to meet a young woman who was also graduating. And we went out about January. And by the end of February, I proposed to her, but in such an ambiguous way that she wasn't quite sure, and finally said, "Well, are you coming out to Madison with me?" I'd been offered a scholarship. She said, "In what capacity?" And I said, "Oh, no, I mean marriage." And it took her about a week, and then we got married. So I did have a companion coming out into a part of the world that I had never seen. Until the age of 21, probably 90 miles from New York was my furthest venture. Eastern Pennsylvania and upstate New York were about the limits of and a little bit of Connecticut. So I was extraordinarily provincial. Even downtown New York was not my turf. It was the turf for rich people. My only venture into that world was they came around auditioning for young children for a children's chorus in Metropolitan Opera, and I spent 3 years down there until my voice changed. That was fabulous.
So really coming to Wisconsin was like the Wild West or something?
It seemed like another world. Mm-hmm. You think of Madison as a metropolitan area. I thought of it as a rural village. And I kept a subway bus token in my pocket if I ever needed to go back fast, assuming that somehow down right behind the Capitol there must be a subway station.
So you got to Madison because of your then wife?
I got to Madison. I had made out applications. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that interested me at Madison, I wanted to work with a professor, Merle Curti, who was probably the most famous history teacher in Madison at the time. He was in the American intellectual history, but I thought that I would be able to do something that would be transatlantic. I was determined to do something with Europe, and I came to work with him. And the first day I arrived, I went in, it was I think August or early September 1955, went in to see the chairman, William Saxe, I believe. Saxe was his name, I think it's William was his first name, and he sat me down and asked me about my background and my interests, and I told him I had come to work with Merle Curti. He said, "Oh," he said, "did you?" He said, "Well, you know, Merle Curti is on fellowship this year. He's on leave, and he won't be here. So I'm going to introduce you to a new man that's just arrived. His name is George Mossy, and you will be comfortable with him." I thought to myself, how the hell does he know who I'll be comfortable with, and why would he even use that phrase? And later I found out, and I will let you know when the time comes. I realized that I was a virgin, and this man was also a virgin to Wisconsin. And that, in fact, determined the composition of the first seminar. You want me to go on?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Walked into the seminar, and there are these people ranging from baby faces like myself, freshmen, all the way up to people who are writing their dissertations. There were people working in German history, Italian history, French history, British history, all there because of a common interest in intellectual history, which was going to be George Morrissey's assigned forte for the university. And it was a really a motley crew. Some of these people were well formed. They were on their way. They were writing their dissertations. They were mature graduate students, and others were just like me, completely wet behind the ears. And that meant that the older ones were the ones that set the tone, and the tone was also set by our new instructor, who gave us the impression right away with his statement, "This is a history seminar. We reserve nice comments for the sherry hour afterward. This is a critical analytical seminar." I immediately got the message, "This is a bullfight, and we are the bulls, and we are also the picadors and toreadors, and that's the way it's going to be." And it was really an education. I'll just give you one example because it was the example of my life. I was assigned, he said, everybody has to bring in one paper a week. He's not going to do any of the talking. He'll talk at the end, he'll summarize. But you're assigned a paper, you bring it in, and everybody has the task of going at it critically. So I thought, I'm not ready for this. The older folks will have to go. But he went around, and we were sitting in order, and I got week number four. This is week number one. 3 weeks. Come up with a topic for your master's. You're going to get your master's fast in a year, so you better come up with try to come up with a topic very quickly. Okay, I know French. I run into the Memorial Library and I start pulling books in French history up. Now that doesn't seem to work. It's not going to work fast enough. French novels. Start pulling out French novels and I say, what would I be interested in French novels? Or should you give me a transnational, the kind of transnational thing I had come to work with? French novels, novelists who write about America in the 19th century. So I started pulling off a few books and I realized I do have something to work with. And one book I had known was there already was Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville's Traveling Companion to America in 1831. Gustave de Beaumont, who had written a book called Marie ou l'esclavage aux États-Unis, Marie or Slavery in the United States. So I look at that and I think, okay, I've got a topic. And I quickly cobble together an introductory essay. And I walk in and they tore me to pieces. It was put together hastily. You didn't do this. This is a non sequitur. This is no good. Why do you put this in? What's your thesis? And I'm sitting there and diminishing very rapidly in my own eyes, wanting to be out of there, going out of that seminar and saying, going home to my wife and saying, I think we're going to have to move back to New York. I think I've been finished by these folks. It took me a day to recover. I did not ever tell anyone this until my dissertation defense. And I told George about this. And it later entered his lore. He would tell all future graduate students coming in how one of his better students had been reduced to tears and went out weeping from the seminar, which was, of course, a total exaggeration, but in typical George fashion. In any event, he loved when he heard that. He couldn't get over it, and of course, none of the other graduate students ever got over it, but he was able to set the right tone because he told them this student almost broke down, but in fact, not only survived, but went off to a very prestigious institution when he got his PhD. So that is the fall of 1955. Well, there's another part of George that has to be talked about, because this was his undergraduate teaching. George, if you saw him, you realized that he was a cut above all the other lecturers that you could possibly attend. I only had one person in City College who came close to him. This was Hans Kohn, and I realized that I could only mention that once, because George did not like rivals, and he kind of said, yes, but I'm better, am I not? And of course, said, yes, of course you are. But in his lecture, this was the first lecture, of course, and he had a relatively ordinary classroom, full, but not immensely full. And I would sit up in front with my jeans, which was I had one other pair of pants, and listen right in front and drink it up and be critical at the same time, because I realized, okay, if you're going to be like this to us, we've got to learn how to be like this to you when the time comes for you to talk. You want us to be seminar students who are critical? We'll be critical. And I listened and I loved it. I mean, he was absolutely fascinating. But I didn't know where I stood with him. This is late in the first part of the term. I'm getting good grades, a midterm. But where do I stand in the seminar? Was this first baptism of fire an indication of my standing? Is it worth my while continuing? And one day toward the end of the term, he said, come to the office. Come to my office. I go into his office and he said, there's a small fellowship waiting for you. It's $200. Oh. And he said, and the first thing I want you to do with that fellowship is to get yourself another pair of pants. I can't stand watching you only in jeans. Jeans were not the garb of everybody by then. He said, you've got to have another pair of pants. It's just impossible. I went off. I picked up my fellowship. And it wasn't until you began to ask me about this interview that I realized he may have created that fellowship. It may have been his money that he put in there. How does the history department come to give a fellowship? They may have had some money, but I have a feeling that he just wanted to show me, you know what? It's okay. I've watched you now. You take your turn as the bull, but then you become the picadors. And I was doing pretty well as a picador. I learned my craft pretty well. And by the time the second or third year, we were all masters of slaughtering each other and then surviving for the next day. It was a wonderful cartoon in French history where there's in the Third Republic, they have ministers who constantly walk the plank on a pirate ship, but there's another plank under it. They fall, they hit the plank, and they go back in. And so I always told my graduate students, that's what it is in a seminar. It can only kill you, but they don't really destroy you and come back and you're a better person. Anyway, so I knew that I was on the good side, and pretty soon I got a chance to see that he really thought very highly of me. Do you want me to go on with this, or shall I?
I've got many questions, but okay. If there are places you want to go,
I'll just continue a little bit more with that. 56, I have to say this about George. He was a combination to me, and this is why I wasn't really very comfortable with him. This was a man who announced that he had been from the upper classes of Germany. That put us at one distance. He had gone to a Quaker high school in England, Bootham, I think it was. And he spoke with a British accent. So he was a combination of a German bourgeois and an English gentleman, neither of which I was. And it kept ringing in my head, why am I supposed to be comfortable with this man? I'm not comfortable at all. He's an exotic European, and I'm a Bronx American. And then it became clear to me why Saxe had said this to me. In the fall of 1956, the year after I was there, the Suez War broke out. The Israelis invade Suez. Within a couple of days, they're down to the Nile. The British and the French come in. And George Mossy comes into the seminar with a slight grin on his face, and he says, these Jews have become Prussians. And then he smiles a little bit, like, you know, they know how to fight. And I thought, he wouldn't be saying that unless he had some link. I don't think what my first idea was, this is a guy who may have a Jewish background somewhere, but he's obviously an Episcopalian or a Quaker. He's not Jewish. But there I said, maybe he's nothing, but obviously there's a linkage there. Other than that, he was a closed book to us. This seminar, made up of a composite, was not like it was 10 years later when people came because he was there, because they knew him. This was a man who was introducing himself to us and us to him. And for the time I was there, it was a much more open seminar. People went in all directions, Reformation history, 19th century Britain. I'm picking up on Alexis de Tocqueville. And we didn't know where he was going. And I didn't find out until I left. When his first major book on German history, The Crisis of German Ideology, hit me like a thunderstorm. I said, this is what he's been working on. He had kept it all to himself. And it was intriguing that was the beginning. That was only the first blossom in something that just blew. Nationalization of the masses, in which he talks about how people are, psychologically mobilized. Towards the final solution in terms of racism, moving into the First World War and the wounded soldiers and the dead soldiers and what is done with the death of the Civil War. Talking about Jewish history, he opened up Jewish history at the University of Wisconsin. All these things like a flowering, and then of course the final capstone, coming out as a gay individual. All of these absolutely unknown to us, any of us, in the course of it. We thought of him as a sexless Buddha who was interested in pure intellectual history of Europe, the classics and popular culture, and that was it. And that was the place from which he went. And his main publications had been in 17th century England. So that was George in general. When I went in 56, my wife, who's played as much of a role in my development as did George, not just my development as a human being, but in history, she said to me one day, there's a new thing called Fulbright scholarships. Why don't you apply? This is the fall of 1956. I've been there a year, got my master's degree, have worked on an article which passed through the seminar with flying colors. And so I said, okay, I'll try. And I write out a little thing about what I'd like to study, which is a break off from the master's degree. And I get it, and it comes through. I hadn't told George about this at all. I walk up to the Bascom Hill, and I say to George, I've just gotten a Fulbright scholarship, and I'm going to Paris next year. And he looks at me and says, you can't do that. He said, you haven't passed your comps. You're in the middle of things. What are you doing? Why did you apply for a Fulbright? I said, my wife suggested I'd apply. I applied. Should I not go? He said, of course you're going. He said, this is an incredible opportunity. He said, but you better work hard there. Off to Paris I went. In Paris I discovered that somebody, a French scholar, had just done a 1,400-page thèse, the classic thèse of the French, on the very topic I was interested in. So I thought, I'm going to work on somebody I had read, who I read in college, Alexis de Tocqueville, and I'm going to work on his something that nobody has studied, his relationship to England. And while I was there, I'll go into this story later if you want, but while I was there, I decided that we should take a trip to England. We had a scooter, we drove through Europe on it, Lambretta. We get to England, George happens to be there, and he says, I'm going to take you up to Cambridge. He had spent a year in Cambridge, and I will show you around. And George transforms himself as we reach Cambridge into an English gentleman, a young English gentleman, an undergraduate who knows the ropes and can show us what Cambridge is like as opposed to Wisconsin. They have a historic landscape here and a little river in which people go punting on the little boats. And George, to show us how marvelous he is, takes us punting. I said, Ruth, get your camera ready. This guy is going to get stuck. He's reached the end. As long as he was intellectual, talking about the King's College Chapel, it was fine. He's getting out in a boat now. This guy better watch out. And of course, she caught him at the moment when he had to make a decision as to whether to hold on to the punter, whatever it's called, the pole, and miss the boat, or leave the reel in the water, in the mud, and go along with the boat. And he left it, and we got back. And I can't mock him, because then he said, you do it. And I get the same thing happened to me. These are things you learn. Anyway, George wanted to keep us there for the whole time we were in England. And we finally said to him, George, we've got to get out. I've got to see something about England besides you. And he said, okay, go do it. Okay. You want to ask a question? I've got one more thing, which is, I think, the most important thing. Yes. I'm going to move right to the
heart of the matter.
The PhD thesis.
Okay.
I tell him I'm going to work on Alexis de Tocqueville. He says, fine. He loves everybody to take their own. He's a charismatic figure, but he's not a Pied Piper. He doesn't want imitators. He wants people to venture. I start working, and I begin to produce my chapters for the seminar. And after about the second chapter, he says to me privately, why would you work on a man like Alexis de Tocqueville? He's so sane. And I realized, sane, S-A-N-E. He's not one of these mythical, irrational creatures whom he loves to study. And I said, well, George, I happened to get hooked on this guy, and I wrote a poem about one of his books, so I guess that's, you know, touches the aesthetic a little bit. And he said, that was fine. And then by early 1960, I'm ready to do my thesis, and I get very ill. I have a leaking appendix, go to the hospital over here in Madison. It turns out to be a very complex operation. I'm up on tubes for 3 weeks in the hospital, constantly losing weight. My intestines don't work. George doesn't show up for 2 weeks. Finally, my wife tells me I'm beginning to get better. He comes in and he says, okay, I've got good news for you. Now he knows that it's worthwhile investing himself in me, okay? I don't think he'd like to see somebody smelling of pus and okay, and all the rest. He says to me, you got your job at, I put you in for a job at Harvard and you've got a job. I said, George, I can't do this. I said, I haven't finished my research on Tocqueville. The big primary research at Yale, I've got to go back and do it. He said, nonsense, you're not going to do that. You're going to go and take the job. And you're going to write the dissertation, and it's going to be written by June, because that's what you need. I said, George, what am I going to do? He said, your topic is Tocqueville in England, right? I said, right. He said, you write. Tocqueville said this, Tocqueville said that, and you get your degree, and you're out of here. You'll touch up the thesis for the book later on. And that's a message which I've been able to communicate to all of my graduate students. The dissertation is a union card. If you work for 10 years on your dissertation, you put out a book-style book, really a good book, nobody will publish it because it all goes on digital dissertations. And what do they do with it? Anybody has access. Nobody's going to publish it. So he got me uplifted, and that was the moment of, to me, it was a supreme moment. Mm-hmm. It was a moment of utter confidence in me, a moment in which he sending me off, and he knew that I had to make my career out there with a dissertation. It turned out Harvard was a very different place from Madison, a much more hierarchical place, but I was then on my way.
And you were his first placement at Harvard?
Yes, yes. I may have been his last, but I think they needed somebody then, and he probably pushed my name forward, and that was it. And I had about a half-hour interview before.
Do you think you were unique in the amount of attention he gave you as a graduate student, or did he really take such a deep interest in the well-being of...
That's one of the major points that has to be made about George. We all felt, all of us, that he was paying a lot of attention to us. And first of all, you have to realize, we had the luck of having a man who had no wife, no children. We were his children. We were his mates. Mm-hmm. And we had all the seminars at his home. And Sherry was served. And we could say nice things to each other after the seminar. And I had the feeling that every one of us, every single one of us, was followed very closely and very carefully. And as he got into his full stride after we left, I think he attracted people for precisely the same reason. He paid attention. One of the people came later. I met him at one of the meetings in Madison we had at the very end of the 1990s. And he said to me, he came to Madison as an undergraduate, and here was a man who came down to the Lake Mendota, the waterfront, sat down. He recognized him from the undergraduate, sat down and started talking to him right away. Only faculty member he had ever met who did that. George did use his social and spare time. He had to have a special talent for attracting people. Didn't have a built-in mm-hmm. family and a built-in wife and a built-in social manager, as wives frequently are, or husbands if their wives are working. And so he developed that sense of investment. No, I was never unique. I knew that and I wanted that. I was not even one of his housekeepers. He had housekeepers, and they were, I think, most intimately involved with him, and they would love to belittle him in his daily work. He was a complete incompetent at doing housework and washing dishes and the rest of that. So they could get a feeling of at least technical superiority in the housework, even though they were not his intellectual equals as yet.
Do you have any ideas about where his skills as a lecturer and a mentor and it came from?
it?
That I can't tell you. I know, I do know that he was hired by Wisconsin for his ability to draw crowds. He had first gone to Iowa. I don't know how he developed it. I do know something. Yes, my brother-in-law, during the Second World War, was in some training camp, and George was lecturing on the background of Germany, and he said George would always just walk to the front and make these two little steps and burst out with something. He was already a unique teacher. I don't know where he got it from, but he obviously developed it at Iowa to the point where he was teaching to 1,000 students. And when he came to Wisconsin, it was because of that. And the very second semester of his teaching, he walked into the room, and the room was not only full, but there were students out in the hall. There was long lines of students. And he said, oh, well, we've got ourselves a bigger room. There are just too many students. And we all poured out of the room, marching down to the next hall. And one of the students next to me said, this is the biggest migration since the Exodus. And that's the way we felt. I mean, but it was a Moses who didn't want to lead. His whole life was telling, charisma is one thing, but be wary of it. Mm-hmm. And be critical. And that's why he was training us all to be very critical. It's very easy to get people to be convinced of that. But be convinced of your specialness.
It's
a danger.
Such an interesting contrast to the Holocaust, of which he was...
Oh, yes, exactly. He was saying that the basic big question, why is it? How is it that so many people get caught up in so much irrationality and myth?
Yes.
And then I can say something about the Festschrift, because that's the next step was the end of the 1970s. George told David Sabin, who was another of his students, I'm going to be 65 soon, Dave. I might die. I want to have a Festschrift while I'm still alive. You get Seymour Drescher and somebody else that we mentioned, Alan Sharlin, and you get a Festschrift for me. I want it in 3 years. And so we did it. There's a man who knew exactly what he wanted. And it was a really exhilarating work. And as disciples will do, we fought over what to say in the introduction. David wanted him to be a quasi-Marxist and emphasize George's focus on class. I wanted him to George to be a student of mass society, and so I wanted to insist on his cross-class analysis about the ideology and its appeal, especially German ideology. And so we quarreled in a wonderful correspondence for about 3 months, and Alan Sharlin stepped in and voted, I think, mostly with me. So we got that in. And so at the Festschrift, my talk was basically taken from our correspondence, the debate between the clearly classy Mossy and the mostly massy Mossy. And that was the Festschrift. But the most important thing that happened at the Festschrift was getting back to Mr. Merle Curdy, who gave a talk, and who explained how George got to Madison. He apparently came here very briefly, impressed people with his ability to draw crowds. They wanted somebody in Western civilization who could teach lots of students. And so he was put on a list of people who were potential appointments. There were no Jews on the history department at that time. George obviously had the best credentials. That's Iowa, 1,000 people with the best credentials. But he wound up only one of three people, and he wound up choice number three. And they hired someone else, I believe, in 1954, an independently wealthy scholar who, by the end of the first term, decided he didn't want to teach all his life. This was not what he wanted to do, spend his time in a classroom. And so he left at the end of the year. Number two had already gotten a job at another place, and so there they were. George Mossy came, having been acknowledged as eligible and now hired by default. And Merle Curdy said it was a very interesting, he wouldn't go into the details, to see how difficult it was as late as 1954 to get into the history department somebody who was of that particular background. And I know this was the case because in the economics department, a very famous economic historian, Selig Perlman, was on the history department list for outside evaluators, and after, I think in 1939, refused to serve anymore. He said, if they're good enough to be your graduate students, one of them should be good enough, that he meant Jews, should be good enough to be in the history department. But it took them another 14 years to get around to that. But, you know, we came into a different world because I experienced, you asked about anti-Semitism, nothing in my street. Bronx High School of Science had 70% Jews, City College had 60% Jews. So I was always in a majority situation. And when I got to Wisconsin, that had almost, not quite, but almost disappeared. My way was clear. By the end of the 50s, people were going out of their way as a kind of silent affirmative action to prove that they were no longer bigoted, from Illinois and other places which had been restrictive. And it was Georgia students who were going out and breaking ice everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any conversations with him about being Jewish, just personally? And
no, I steered away from, oh yes, later on, mm-hmm. after he came out with the crisis of German ideology, and then he started to have the Jewish program, we did have, and he was not at all identified religiously. I think at his funeral, he did not want Kaddish read, mm-hmm. but he did want to be identified as a Jew. I think he was very concerned and terribly concerned with Israel's development, not just its existence, but he had a list of people who were his culture heroes. That is, early Zionists who wanted an integrated or a two-state solution for the problem of Palestine long before it was even formed. And my favorite City College teacher, Hans Kohn, was a man who had been disillusioned by the divisions, by the fact that the Jews in Palestine were not sufficiently cognizant of the fact that they had a real massive problem of people living on the land already and were not addressing themselves to it, were trying to look the other way. And so I think George felt affiliated in that way. One of his friends, his very young life friends, once told me that she sat in a seminar in Jerusalem, and he was talking about Jews in the early 30s, and someone in the seminar asked him, what did it feel like to be a Jew in the early 30s? He said, well, you could take a walk over to East Jerusalem. You might get some inkling there, what it feels like to be a minority, to be rendered, insecure, constantly and totally insecure. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of affiliation he had, a great and deep, I think, an abiding affection and a deep interest in the history of Judaism, but also a sense of wariness about the way Israel was developing.
And the nationalism.
And the nationalism, of course, yeah. And that's part of his, mm-hmm. the dangers of nationalism. Mm-hmm. People who cease to worship God and worship themselves. That's the opening theme of the French Revolution and the nationalization of the masses. And it's a thing that sticks in your mind, and it runs right through that. And worshiping is the key. Mythologies that you build up in order to create myths.
Tell me a little bit more about his approach to history and the use of empathy and that.
Well, I can do it best by talking about how he came to move into the Nazi, in the studies of the background of Nazism and other ideologies. And he did it by taking people seriously. One of the things, really, after the Second World War, one of the things was to dismiss what the Nazis and what Germans had thought in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and especially during the Nazi regime, as some aberrant behavior, propagandism, something that had been developed just to get to power, and that there was no coherence to this ideology. And he said, no, you've got to get inside not just the heads of the Nazis, but the people to whom they were speaking. The pre-Nazis, the German nationalists, you've got to find out what it is that makes people join, empathize, tolerate, things which you might find irrational, not simply to dismiss them because you think that, in fact, because it's irrational, it's incoherent. You can have irrational mythologies which, in fact, embed themselves and appeal deeply to people. And one of his favorite analogies was, if you want to find out what made Nazism so appealing, with its rituals and its decor and its choreography, go into a Baroque church. And you see that what the church is trying to do is not to stress just words, but to appeal to all the senses, to get people to drop their, to let that critical sense relax, to say that there's something different and better and higher than logic and empirical rationalism. And I think that he communicated even to his students in the undergraduate course. He said, pay attention to myths. Pay attention not just to great thinkers, but to the novels that people are reading, the poems that they're writing, the pictures that are being drawn, the way in which movements project a meaning to history and make themselves the endpoint of history. I think it was very important and very dramatic in what he did. And that's why he held, despite his complete carelessness about facts, which made me laugh constantly when I was a TA, and students would turn around and look at me, and I'd say, no, you take down what he says. You're Mirandized. This is before Miranda, but you're Mirandized. You'll be held responsible for any errors that are made. But he didn't care. He was conveying something very different, and it didn't matter. The facts were really, they were petty facts, you know. What's the proof of German influence on America? King of Prussia, the town of King of Prussia in Pennsylvania. Well, that's all the kids get to know. They're not going to know anything about the influence. But his ability to draw, to ad lib, to pull people in, to make them think about things, to make striking observations about, especially about irrational thought, how it links up, how people are hungry for this, how they want it, how they want meaning. It's terrible to walk around with chaos.
Be interesting to hear what he would say today about the political environment.
Oh, he would love it.
We're in.
He would
currently
love it. I mean, this would be grist for his mind. Ah, now the Americans have finally become people who talk irrationally to each other. They scream at each other from across these television stations, these political television stations, and across the internet. And I mean, it's opened up a whole new world of how you convey myths and worldviews. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure he would be having a party with this. Images and words and whole narratives wrapped up in a Facebook, Twitter message.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of what he believed in as the antidote to?
I think best he could do was exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Was to say, this is what you're being subjected to. This is the kind, I mean, you do ultimately need some facts, but you've got to draw people's attention to the facts. If you're teaching people about why the medical men in Germany were one of the chief pillars of the reign, of the regime, why, in fact, they not only were people who went along, but people who wanted to be at the front ranks, wanted to make this new racial revolution, you've got to study why people who raised and take the Hippocratic Oath do no harm, why they'll do a lot of harm. They'll do the opposite. Instead of saving lives, they will destroy lives or sterilize people at a lower level. But they'll do all sorts of things to segregate, incarcerate, and ultimately destroy. Why will they do that? And you'll have to find out that, in fact, they have been led to believe that there's something higher than do no harm to the individual. And that is, very simply, do no harm to the collectivity, the important collectivity. There is life unworthy of life. There are groups unworthy of life. And they must be, in fact, removed from the group. And that's the priority. Not saving every life, which could be, in fact, the worst thing you could do. You save all these epileptics, schizophrenics, tuberculars, deformed children, feeble-minded people. All these things, all they fit together in the same boat. The Jews are one of the primary targets because they pollute invisibly. They have a way of doing things which is invisible. So you've got it. When the people stood in the Nuremberg trials, their defense was, we believed that collective public medicine was the priority for our regime. And the national health was more important than the individual health. can't go better than to show people that, that there's a total transformation of what that Hippocratic Oath actually meant to these men. And that's their defense, right in 1945, 46, 47.
How did his interests and development as a scholar into these areas influence your path and what your interests became?
Okay. Well, in one sense, very little, because when I left, he was still the scholar of the Reformation. But when I worked on Tocqueville, I was not particularly interested in the irrational. Increasingly fascinated by it, but I turned to the idea, okay, we looked at stories that are told by men who are intent on very very horrendous transformations of society and restructuring of society. But is it also possible that there are myths created by people in the name of the good? And so having gotten interested in abolition, I began to be interested in what are the myths of the abolitionists, which is in fact something I'm going to be talking about this afternoon. The myth of the free labor ideology, that free labor is always superior to slave labor. And that's one of the reasons why, in fact, it's much better to introduce emancipation for everybody, because in fact, everybody will be better off. The society will automatically become wealthier and richer. Well, and of course it will be freer. And therefore, it's the myths of the abolitionists which also demand analysis. And it's caused a bit of a stir. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the real impacts that he had on me. And just indirectly, just reading the stuff and reading his material and the way he approached mm-hmm. things.
That's interesting. So as a scholar yourself, as a teacher yourself, mm-hmm. you said he influenced
yeah.
you.
Oh, yeah. The mobilization of the masses is mm-hmm. my big deal with abolition. So that's the big difference between why nobody talked about abolition for 2,000 years and why in 50 years it suddenly became the agenda of a world movement, and by 100 years every civilized society had pledged itself to be anti-slavery instead of slavery. No, it's not a bad transformation. And then, of course, why it doesn't work all the time. Because in Nazi Germany or in Europe itself, you had more slave laborers working in Germany in 1944 than had been working in all of the Americas 100 years before. No. Not, this is not a thing, a tale with a happy ending. In history, there are only occasionally pleasant interludes, no happy endings. That's Drescher, not Mossy, but I'm sure he would have agreed with that.
Tell me a little bit, this is moving back sort of
yeah.
chronologically, just the context of Madison and the history department and anything you can compare to today or contrast from today?
Well, for me, Madison was, first of all, it was an opening up of a whole world. I mean, Madison, but 5 years down the road, I didn't want to leave this. I said, I want to stay for another year, do research. Part of it was, this is so comfortable. This is so wonderful. I've got this great mentor. I've got these wonderful. Mm-hmm. I was finishing my PhD in 5 years. Most of the seminar was they were taking an extra year anyway to do it, and I thought, oh, it would be wonderful to spend another year. Why do I have to go out in the world and work? This way, it's you're sitting on the consuming end rather than the getting out in front and really transforming yourself in relation to the to students. And Madison, to me, was a bit of paradise. I had stepped into this magnificent relationship with this magnificent mentor. There were gathered around him a group of just bright, energetic people who, when they got the message, be as energetic and creative as possible, were responding to it. And he had produced a fabulous set of graduate students. And the history department in general, well, that was less important because at that point, I don't know if they still do it, you went into your major professor's fief, and that's where you stayed for the full 5 years. I took seminars with other people. That's what we did. I never found his near equal. I found some wonderful lecturers in American history, but That wasn't turf that you only went with your major advisor's permission. You went to a certain turf, and if I said I'd like to do such and such, medieval history, good, you can do it. Comparative literature, good, you can do it. Russian history, fine, you can do it. American, you don't need to do American history. That's off your grounds. You've got enough. You had enough undergraduate history in America. You can do that. You can do Tocqueville in England, not Tocqueville in America. Get busy with looking at British history. So that's the way. I mean, it was not just one history department. Although the fact that we called our professors Mr. and not Professor, the fact that when I walked into Harvard, the chairman of the department, with my union card in my hand, I'm now a doctor, he says, call me doctor. I call him doctor. He didn't invite me to sit down. This was a very different thing from Madison, Wisconsin.
It was more egalitarian here.
Much more egalitarian here. But George had his own. I mean, look, you're out to his house every week. You're in a constant relationship with him. So in fact, it feels like more like a family than it does like being at a university, a graduate school. You feel a tremendous degree of comfort and security.
How much did the wider world of politics enter? I mean, this is also the late 50s.
Yep,
the Democratic
constantly.
Party is
sure.
on the ascendancy.
Right.
McCarthy dies.
Right. Just I came out just to witness the last move of McCarthy. I went to work for the guy who was there was a group called the Young Socialists, or Young People's Socialist League. It was the last gasp of them when I came out in 55. I think they were mostly people from New York. And he showed me, he came back one day from a meeting of YPSL, Young People's Socialist League, and he said, this is what they were carrying outside. It said, you know, kikes go back to New York, okay? So that was there. But you know what? It was the left that was beginning to really take off. There was a group of students who founded a new journal called Studies on the Left. They were very committed. In fact, many of them were good, hard Marxists. And mostly what you saw was a general changing of the, I don't know how it had been in 52, 53, 54, but by 56, 57, 58, it's the McCarthy is just gone. Okay. He's vanished. And McCarthyism has vanished. And there's a new ethos that's brewing on the campus. There were highly political events. The U.S. sent troops into Lebanon. There was a protest. There was, of course, the Cold War being fought, but I didn't have much. I mean, I did engage in lots of discussions with the folks on the left, but I was wary of them. Mm-hmm. There was one thing that happened. It was a student, one of the foremost students on the left. We were walking home one night, and his wife had gone, one of the first to go to visit Mao. I think it was 1959, 58 or 59. Must have been 59 or the fall of 58. And I said, well, you know, one thing I can't imagine is what's going on in China. There are thousands, maybe millions of people seem to be dying. The landlord class as a whole. Why do you have to have death as a penalty for living under a revolutionary government? He said to me, you know, you fail to realize life is very cheap in China. I said, so what is the revolution all about? It was cheap. It is cheap. What's the revolution? It's just one more person coming in and taking his cut into the vast tradition of bloody suppression. And so I was a little wary. I stood off from that. I was not. I figured I had one myth in my childhood. It was okay. It was comforting. It lasted for a couple thousand years. Let this new myth of revolutions remaking the world, let's see, last for 50, 100 years. Mm-hmm. What happens to it? Are people wealthier, healthier, happier? We'll see.
Did George become active politically while you were
no.
here in any way?
No,
that you
he never took any
okay.
political positions. I understood that he cautioned the students in you know, the late 60s that they may not, there are unintended consequences that they might get themselves into a position of being those masses who feel that the moment for utopian transformation has arrived. And I do believe that there was an explosion in death here, and it made an impact on mm-hmm. the on the nationwide. And other teachers, other professors had encouraged the students and then backed away when the time came to stand out for them. Because George had cautioned them but always spoke to them, they had a confidence in him. Mm-hmm. He spoke to them straightforwardly, but he wouldn't betray them. He was, in fact, steady, and he did. He went to their defense when the time came. So he was, that's, again, the kind of person he was.
So you worked on the Festschrift. That was 1982.
1982. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about other joint work that you did together.
Okay. In 1984, I was at the Wilson Center, and as I said, I undertook this a program at the, or I'm not sure, I told somebody else before, earlier in the morning, I undertook to set up a program in European studies. And what I liked most about the invitation to join it for a year, just take an additional year off after my fellowship there, was that they said they were setting up a program. It was an all European studies. It was not going to be Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And that attracted me enormously, because my general perspective was, look, Europe has been there for at least 1,000 years, 2,000 years as a concept. And this is just one late development, this division along this particular boundary line. Really what you have to do is discuss the long-term trajectory. And the European division is temporary, or we don't know if it's permanent, but it's got to be a European program. So I came, went eagerly, set up the program. And before I left, they announced to me, well, the State Department was giving money, but only if they separated and made an Eastern European and Western European program. I had asked George to come in and be one of my advisors. You have a little team. And he spoke up very strongly for the retention of this original idea. He was taken by it. I hadn't consulted him before, but he just came in and he just made a beautiful, eloquent statement. But a beautiful, eloquent statement, doesn't talk as loudly as a State Department grant, which is going to be in perpetuum. George Mossy and Seymour Drescher come and go. The money stays, and so we had to wait in 1989 before the two systems then began to fuse again.
But he worked with you on an advisory committee.
An advisory committee, and he came out and helped me to select the fellows for the next year. This is what part of our task was. He came out to give a talk. I got him to give a talk to the Wilson Center, which was really a very prestigious gathering place for intellectuals to meet with politicians. And then our final collaboration, which was not as close as it might have been, was when he asked me to become an editor of the Journal of Contemporary History. And he felt he was getting old. He wanted somebody to replace him. I wasn't sure that I was the person for that, because I had been focusing mostly on 18th and 19th century stuff. The focus of the Journal of Contemporary History had been very heavily on Europe, and I was interested in, and I'd been coming globalized, looking at slavery in global perspective, and transcontinental rather than regional European. But I agreed to go on. I thought it was a wonderful compliment that he paid me. I stayed for a few years, and then I was very happy when Stanley Payne came on the scene. Somebody in the 20th century who had all the networks, who was willing, they didn't want to have reviews. He was willing to, in fact, introduce. I didn't have the confidence to say, look, this is your turf, and I want to put reviews in there, these different things. So I contributed less than I should have, and I was glad that I got out when I did.
Did you and George stay in touch?
Oh, continually.
Always?
Yeah. At the end of about 1997, early 1998, he called me up and we were just talking. It was, I think, the last long conversation we had. And he said, how's your family? I started with my parents. I said, well, my parents are both 90 years old and they're on Social Security. I'll be going on Social Security next year too. So I think it's a pretty nice thing. And I've got an advisor who's got nice longevity, and so maybe I have a feeling that maybe I've got something about me that keeps people alive. He said, yeah, well, you've led a charmed life, he said, and he's absolutely right. And but then a few months later, he developed this, the symptoms which roared through his body very quickly. And I only had time to send him the preface for a book, a collection of my essays, which was coming out and would come out the next year. And I wanted him to see what I had written about him. I'd like to read it if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, I'd love it if you read it.
And this was in the preface. I had a chance to send it to him. And it was, the book was From Slavery to Freedom. And it was a collection of essays written over by 1994, then written over almost 25 years. So generational an exercise as this series of essays is inevitably stimulates multi-generational reflection. My teacher and friend, George Mossy, receives his due only tangentially in these pages, where my historical interests briefly intrude into his own area of expertise. That was the Holocaust, comparing it to the slave trade. Yet no graduate student could ever have had better fortune than to share the exhilaration that was George Mossy's seminar. No aspiring young scholar could have been more challenged to sustained effort than I was by the relentless tide of George Mossy's own work. And no sexagenarian, that is me, standing amazed at the restless energy of his globe-trotting octogenarian mentor, would dare to dream of pausing for a breath in hours, the world's most satisfying preoccupation. I can only be thankful that my wife, Ruth, appeared on the horizon of my life just in time to keep George's example in comparative human perspective. I was blessed with this man.
And it sounds like he felt the same about you.
He did. It was very
mutual.
Very mutual.
We talked a little bit about the uniqueness of his career, and I wondered whether you could say a little bit on tape about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think I have to reiterate something. He was so much of an enigma to me at the beginning, and I think he was an enigma to himself. One of the things that surprised me most was the succession of things that he got interested in. This German ideology, then the mobilization of the masses, this human behavior. The fallen soldiers, what the impact of the First World War, Jewish studies, sexuality and nationalism. This is a man who just didn't just flit from subject to subject, just zoomed and zigzagged from subject. And I don't think any other historian that I've ever met had that kind of breadth, that kind of interest, that way of lending, of getting to a subject where he almost could, you sense that he felt that was in the air and he zoomed into it, and then other people come on board. And you could only fully sense what that had meant when in the posthumous meetings that I attended and the book that came out, what the sheer breadth of his interest was and how he could stimulate people to think about their own work in ways that had nothing directly to do with their own work. Let me give you just one example. At one of the fest trips, the last one that I attended here, an Israeli who had attended his seminars in Madison and was talking about the fallen soldier, talked about the standardization of graves, the fact that all these graves were exactly alike in these World War I memorials, same shape, same size, almost always the same, you know, for king and country or something like it, the same standard slogan. So it was the individual being absorbed into the group, into the nation. And he said, and I'm sure he said that Israeli graves are just the same. I'll bet you your war graves are exactly the same. And this student said, you know what? I took him out to see an Israeli war graveyard, and everyone was different. Everyone had its own shape. And he said, the people who buried these people refused to let the state absorb that. It wasn't their dying and merging with a mission. It was the loss of a family and their membership in the family that was important. Then he said, George said, oh, I like this. I like this graveyard. Mm. This is a good one. So there was, and I've given you one example, but you could see how he touched people again and again and again. As things began, and things just opened up behind him. He's always at the crest of the wave. I think of him as a kind of, to get back to the Cambridge boat incident, intellectually he was, you know, Hawaii 5-0, on the crest, always at the top, keeping a little bit in front, mm-hmm. and for the most part, making waves himself.
So what do you think his legacy is in your mind? I mean, that's such a huge
legacies question. Are something we don't know about.
Yeah.
I find myself being quoted as saying the opposite of what I said, and I realize that once it's out there for anybody to tear apart. There may be people who will deconstruct everything he says to show that he was really the opposite of what he was saying he was. Uh-huh. I have no idea. I do know one thing, that he's obviously still part of the ongoing conversation. When I have a young person visiting me this morning and saying that he's working on an intellectual biography of George Morrissey, still going on, mm-hmm. still stimulating. He's still part of the conversation. And that's really the important thing.
And he did begin these new areas of study here, mm-hmm. with whether it was Jewish studies.
Jewish studies, absolutely. And right at the front of things, mm-hmm. and that's happened.
You said that both the Jewish studies and the gay studies, yep. interests were shocks to you.
Absolute shocks to me. I thought, okay, he might have some affiliation with his Jewish tradition, but that's probably what it amounted to. And he might go to Israel, but okay, he would be talking about Europe to Israelis. But when he started the Jewish studies, that really got me. I said, he's investing his time in this whole new field. I am absolutely positive he didn't have a huge breadth or depth of knowledge when he started to look at it. He plunged into it. And he was, as I said, one of my colleagues who's working with me now was his first teaching assistant there, and said it was amazing how much he seemed to have learned almost overnight. And it just was, again, it was a pleasure. He could stimulate students. He would say things which were not about Judaism or Jewish studies or Jewish affiliations, which would speak to them, whatever they were, whatever their background was, to make that come alive to them as well. And he had that capacity. And he had that idea, there was that sense in his head that you can explain the known, the unknown by the known. Let them make it relevant to somebody in ways that they can feel as part of theirs, that they know, they're familiar with, or they're sympathetic with. Boom, you've got your audience.
Again, that's using the empathy to really connect.
He's making them empathic with the material,
right.
Not necessarily with the message, but the way the message is delivered and why the message could appeal to other people. It's empathy.
I mean, if there are common threads, it seems to me that they have to do with outsiderdom and,
of course,
the influence of being an exile and
right, a pilgrim. Outsider, saying to us, always keep a suitcase packed, you know, that famous phrase, because you never know when the wind is going to turn the other way. So that sense of, and very sensitive. After all, if you're empathic with the plight of outsiders, you are also in a situation where you know that this is a situation of less power. I mean, there's lots of talk now about agency. But to paraphrase George Orwell, everybody is born with agency, but all agencies are not equal.
Yeah. Is there anything I haven't asked you or a story that you've thought of in terms of...
Now, let me see. Let me take a look at my turf thing here.
You mentioned he had a great sense of humor, and that's mm-hmm. sort of come across in a lot of your stories,
but if there
are others that you...
Well, one of the ways in which he could capture the audience was, of course, to make himself an exotic person. One of my graduate students' wives said, when she attended his classes, she said, "You were so exotic. You were old Europe. We could picture you, and that was what Europe was all about." And he would play on that. On his Festschrift program, we put one of his little sayings he said, which was totally absurd, but actually was perfect in its slogan hearing. I was born to rule the German Empire. I was educated to rule the British Empire, and they both vanished before my very eyes. Okay, now, of course, he wasn't born to rule the German Empire. He was a Jew, and he was not going to become a ruler of the German Empire, and he was not going to be born to rule the British Empire because he was also born a Jew. In fact, one of the things that happened in England, I don't know if he ever told the story to anybody, was that one of his history teachers, I think Trevelyan, called him in once and said, "You are a very bright student, but either you better go into journalism or go to America as of 1938, because it's going to be very difficult for a person of your background to get into the British establishment." Now, it had been done, but there were very few on the ground that were.
Meaning Jews shouldn't study history.
Jews shouldn't attempt, no, they can study history all they want. Don't attempt to get a job in it.
Okay.
That's the difference, yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. You know, he had an unusual late life experience of coming into a lot of family wealth. Mm-hmm.
Another surprise, right? All the intellectual surprises, this was another one. Finally, money could talk back.
So
not like
the
Wilson Center.
Tell me about that and whatever you
Well, I found out about it. One of the things I immediately did, I went to Berlin to Germany in 2000 because my wife had fled with her parents in August of 1939 to America. And she was invited back to Stuttgart, which was her city of birth, to make her an honorary citizen again and to make her a real citizen if she wished, and she did. She became a real citizen. And we took a trip to Berlin, and of course we went to see the newspaper building in which George's father and grandfather had owned. A huge building on a block, a city block, and that was, I think, the basis of the wealth that accrued to him. And you went in there, and there were two things that were obvious. There was one little museum, just an alcove smaller than this little space around us, which had the history of the newspaper, which he made, I think, as a condition of the getting the money from the German government. The second thing was there was a space there for the Jewish studies and a third for gay studies. That had to be part. The rest they could do what they wanted. But that was part of his conditions. And I think there was a twinkle in his eye there, too. I mean, it was not only he was getting something back from, history had turned around in his favor, but also putting gay studies in there meant that all of 19th century culture was being transformed in that little space as well, and people could study this perfectly openly and freely. I knew nothing about how much money he had. I thought it was only $5 million, not $14 million or something like that. I didn't ever ask him what he was going to do with all that money. My father was convinced that, in fact, he ought to leave it to all his graduate students. I said, that one wasn't going to happen. And I said, it didn't need to happen. His graduate students were very comfortable, thank you. And
he helped set them up already.
Right. But my father had, of course, been an orphan in the First World War, no parents, and in the Depression, didn't have much of a job most of the time. So he was very anxious to get his hands on anything that would make him secure if he could. But George, never spoke to me about what he was going to do with the money. He mentioned once in passing, he said, "I will do something good with it," and I expected that he would. I had no idea that he would create this fabulous institution that he has created with the money. And that and he was very grateful to this university. He may have had a trouble getting in the front door at the very beginning, but I think he felt that they were enormously good to him throughout the rest of his career. And he would never thought of going anywhere else. And I don't know, but I'm convinced that if like others who make a sufficient mark on the world, you do get invitations. Mm-hmm. And I think he felt very, very loyal to this institution.
Do you have any sense of how the community responded to his coming out?
Here? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Or just...
Didn't make a single ripple. I knew he was gay long before he was... We actually said so because I saw him once at the American Historical Association, a meeting, and he embraced somebody and kissed them on the lips. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. He isn't really a sexless Buddha like we always thought. I said, I mean it. Look, I came out of a very sheltered, I thought there were people who may act effeminate, but there was nobody who was really effeminate. I mean, that really had bond. I thought of this as really one of the myths made up about people who were effeminate. It didn't happen. There weren't any really gay people. I mean, it was a subconscious thing. I never discussed it. Nobody else, none of the other of us ever even speculated that he had anything like a different sexual orientation. Nothing. Sexless was the key. So again, all of these things, a man and this man, like surprise, if you stood back and you look at his life, it's like one of these fireworks shows. You see this come out, that come out, next thing come out, and you say, okay, what's next? Because this is a bottomless pit. There's going to be more to come if you wait long enough.
Well, shades of George Mossy in your current teaching, scholarly works, all of it.
Have the myth of the free labor ideologies in my next project because I'm going to carry it all the way through to past the Second World War. In fact, today I'll give a hint of what my aim is in doing this. And standing in front of a classroom, knowing that what George said, you shouldn't be a textbook wired for sound. Don't be afraid to say outrageous things. Although, as he said to me, if he had said some of the things in 1995 that he said in 1955, he would have lost his tenure. Like when Bermuda shorts came in, he said, why are you girls all wearing that thing? You all look ugly in it. Now, that would have been on the campus newspaper. They would have hauled him before the dean. You can imagine what would have happened. So things have changed. In some ways, things have gotten much freer. In other ways, of course, the taboos always exist. And so if it's not one, it's the other.
Any ideas what conversations he would be in today?
Oh, my gosh. I think every lecture would contain some allusion to, he loved to watch television, December Bride, so he could get his finger on the pulse of America. Now he would be surfing, I'm sure. That's one technology he could learn. He would surf the net and wait for something ridiculous to be said. If he was smart, he'd be watching Jon Stewart, because that's where you get some of the most intelligent dialogue produced as clips, but a man who can condense things marvelously and just bring things to your attention. But I think he would make use of, as he did from the Eisenhower era on, make use of everything that came across his inner brain screen and project it outward in some of his lectures. Make sure he alluded to that, okay? I found, for example, I always want to talk about masturbation as part of liberalism, okay? If you're going to have a free society, everybody has to control themselves, okay? So this is why some people in the 19th century got so excited about it. It hadn't made people very excited before the 18th century, okay? Now everybody's concerned, don't touch yourself, okay? And you've got to learn not to touch yourself. But how are you introduced it to a class? Because I figure I'm looking out at these kids, somebody's going to say, I'm introducing things that make them uncomfortable in class. So what I talk about is the anti-masturbation movement, okay? Now that's, okay, who can object, right? Anti is always better. And then I talk about, in one of his books, he has a little wax, Napoleon put up a little wax museum against masturbation, and you had a little boy and a little girl in different stages of what happens to you if you continue to abuse yourself, okay? And the last one, the little boy's wax penis is down on the floor. So I said, thereafter they closed it. And by the time you get to the mid-19th century, they don't want to put penises out on the floor. So fathers take their sons to the tertiary ward of syphilis sufferers and show them insane. And so they will wear protection when they have sex, you know, that kind of thing. And you want to keep those things. And I can allude to AIDS. Mm-hmm. And to circumcision, which, you know, they've made correlations with that. We can go into that. But I think I can picture him more. I can't picture him what next. That was the wonderful thing. I could never picture what he's going to do next. But in the lecture, I can hear him. That I can always hear him doing. And I can always hear him bringing this or that in. And he would have done, of course, much more than I would have even thought, imagined. But that's, I mean, the infinite ingenuity of the human brain. We all can pick out things.
This is a complete non sequitur, but I did fail to ask you about a film that you mentioned, I believe, that you made in 68.
Oh, yes. Back to Irrationality. Oh, yes. That
so maybe
was
it's not
sheer
a complete...
fun.
Yeah.
And he loved it.
Because, tell me about it.
What happened, you know, the events of 1968. The students go out, and in France, the workers also go out, and they bring France to a standstill. And I was in Paris in 68, 69 with my family, and watching, just, I came in the summer of 68, so the events themselves were over, but they had what you would call, what do you call it when there's an earthquake, aftershocks, and the police and the revolutionaries were constantly getting to it, and my son was 8 years old, and for him this was like, you know, street theater, right? And he sees these long police lines moving down toward the students, and he says, let's follow them, we'll see action. I said, we don't follow anybody anywhere. If you ever see police walking, you don't go anyplace, because these police, when they started, these are the CRS, the security police, they take your head against the ground, they play a little game of ball. Head against the pavement, comes up, stick against the head, goes back down, bang, bang, bang. It's like a little ping pong, okay? Anyway, students come, some French students, they've taken films of these events, about 9 hours worth of film, and I look at them and I think, well, this is just spliced films of different events. What if I can put it together? I put them together in a 50-minute with a friend of mine and a 50-minute colleague in a 50-minute film called Paris, Confrontation Paris 1968. And basically, it's what happens when you literally say, we're gonna really overthrow this whole bourgeois culture, this whole social culture. We're gonna make a complete, total social revolution. And the imagination to power was the slogan, okay? Anything you want to do. And they inverted all of the bureaucracies. They closed down the hospitals. They seized the theaters. And finally, the outcome was, at the end of our film, they didn't produce this film. We had a little bit of photo about what happens at the end. Government calls for a national election, and the conservatives win the biggest majority that they have ever won. And what did the government do? In our film, we had shown the streets afterward, and there were burnt out cars, Duchevaux and Volkswagens and Mercedes, all burnt out. But there's nothing around them. There's burned out cars on the block. And I said, it's funny that the government took these pictures. About 30 years later, I read a study. Government made a deliberate decision. We'll clean out the debris around the streets, but we leave the burned cars there until after the election. Let people walk into the polling booth and say, that could be my car. I don't want that to happen. Enough people to give the conservatives, as I said, the biggest majority that they have. I don't think they ever matched it again. And they made, I thought, if things go too far in France now, we will have the scenario. It may work itself out in the same way. Okay. So then that would have been George's advice to students, watch out for utopia. You may get what you wish for, but it may not look like what you want.
Okay. Anything else?
I have a dry mouth by
You've
now.
You've done a wonderful
and
job.
And I've got a talk to give tonight.
I know. Well, thank you very much for letting me interview you, and thank you even more for honoring George in this way.
That's great. This is my obligation to him. This is such an opportunity. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. And I hope for your sake and for mine and for George's that you keep going with this and get as many people before they die as possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.